From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nelson Mandela celebrated all over the world today in his death at 95. In life, he was that rarest figure, a global moral hero, freedom fighter, a prisoner for decades under brutal apartheid, and then president of South Africa and visionary icon of reconciliation, of dignity for all. This hour, On Point, Understanding Mandela. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What did Nelson Mandela mean to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear in this hour from South Africans, freedom fighters, analysts looking back at Mandela and ahead for South Africa. Here, singing in the streets today in Soweto, Nelson Mandela territory after the announcement of his death. Joining me first today from Cape Town, South Africa, is Peter Wanekot, Africa Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. What is the scene in the streets of Cape Town today?
Well, obviously, the news broke very late last night in South Africa, so many South Africans woke up to this news. It wasn't news that was entirely unexpected. Mr. Mandela had been ill for years, and particularly ill in the last couple of months. But still, it was for many people hard to imagine that he was no longer with us. So in public spaces, there was some singing, some dancing, and just a collective reminiscing about the person that Mr. Mandela was and how he will be missed.
Peter, from your experience in Africa and South Africa, is there a difference in South Africa today in the way Mandela is seen, will be remembered between black and white communities?
Well, it's interesting. He is seen as a someone who perhaps more than any other politician was able to bridge rather gaping the racial divide here. And F.W. de Klerk, his former foe who kept him in prison and later became his deputy president and co-Nobel laureate for the Peace Prize, held a press conference today and praised Mr. Mandela, said he became a friend after they both left politics, and hoped that his life would help people remember the need for reconciliation among blacks as well as whites.
We're hearing the news that his funeral will be a state funeral, perhaps in a week or so, that President Obama may well attend. Do you know anything more about plans for honoring Nelson Mandela in state funeral and beyond?
Well, about the only thing that's bigger than a wedding in South Africa is a funeral. And this is going to be the biggest funeral of them all. In fact, it's going to be held in one of the Johannesburg soccer stadiums that hosted the World Cup soccer tournament. That will be led by a period of memorial in which other provinces will hold memorial services. And then 5 days later, on December 15th, Mr. Mandela will be buried in his ancestral home of Kunu in the Eastern Cape. And that's where many of his relatives are buried and where his family wanted him to rest.
Nelson Mandela came out of prison, worked for the end of apartheid, became president of South Africa, and brought this theme of reconciliation and a great spirit of hope to South Africa and the world. In your assessment, Peter, where does that hope stand today? Is South Africa still a place that has that kind of Mandela optimism and vision around it, or is that receding? Is it still strong?
Well, there's always hope. The thing about Nelson Mandela was, yes, he was an idealist, but he was also a pragmatist. And we forget that he went into prison as a militant, someone that at the time of his arrest in 1962 was scouting for infrastructure targets to perhaps blow up and sabotage. But he came out of prison more than two decades later as someone who believed that the only way to heal South Africa, the only way to keep it together, was to forgive those who had left him in jail and try this this brand of reconciliation. It helped calm a lot of jitters. It brought foreign investment back into South Africa. It helped the economy take off. And there was just one... There was a period where Mr. Mandela also was able to step down from the presidency after only one term, something that that has been admired widely throughout Africa. So, yeah, he was an idealist, but also someone who set a pragmatic example.
Nelson Mandela, idealist, pragmatist, hero to many around the world. Peter Wanekot has joined us from Cape Town, South Africa, Africa Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. In Cape Town today, Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu paid tribute here to Nelson Mandela.
He made us feel we were members of one family. And so we have lost our father.
Desmond Tutu. And today in Johannesburg, Frederick William de Klerk, South Africa's last apartheid-era president, one-time nemesis of Nelson Mandela, but the man under whose rule Nelson Mandela was ultimately released from prison, paid tribute to the anti-apartheid leader, Mandela.
I think his greatest legacy to South Africa and to the world is the emphasis which he has always put on the need for reconciliation, on the importance of human rights.
And here's Mandela himself receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993 for his work in bringing peace and stability to South Africa.
We live with the hope that as she battles to remake herself, South Africa will be like a microcosm of the new world that is striving to be born. This must be a world of democracy and respect for human rights. A world freed from the horrors of poverty, hunger, deprivation, and ignorance.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Nelson Mandela. With us now from Albany, New York, is South African Penelope Andrews. She grew up in Cape Town under apartheid, is now president and dean of Albany Law School, author of The Post-Apartheid Constitutions. Nelson Mandela wrote the foreword to her book. Penelope Andrews, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, you are welcome.
And with us from Chicago, Douglas Foster, professor of journalism at the Medill School at Northwestern University, oversees Medill's journalism residency program in South Africa, and is author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Douglas Foster, welcome. Thanks for joining us from Chicago.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Penelope Andrews, you grew up under apartheid. Now Nelson Mandela has died. Your thoughts, your feelings today?
Well, it's sort of a mixed feeling. There's grief, of course, even though we expected Mr. Mandela to die, but also I have a great sense of celebration that this was this remarkable life, this iconic figure who represented so much, and we have so much to celebrate. I'm sad. I'm also, want to join in. I really want to be in South Africa. Yeah. I think that today and for the next few days, there will just be the sort of reinvigoration which Mandela made possible when he was released from prison and now again. So, yes, a sadness and jubilation.
Douglas Foster, how do you describe what it was exactly? I mean, if for anyone who lived through it, we feel it, we know it, but how would you put it into words? What put him up there in that rank of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, epic figures? What raised him to that level?
Well, I think the thing that's important to remember about Rolihlahla Dalibunga Mandela, the name Nelson came to him later thanks to a teacher at his Christian school, that he spanned so many parts of South African society and culture. He came from a rural tradition. He became a lawyer on his own hard-earned way, and then he traded in that hard-earned privilege for the struggle. He became a guerrilla leader. a prisoner, a president, a wise figure guiding things from the distance since he stepped away from the presidency in 1999. So I think it's the combination of the fact that he outlived so many of his comrades who didn't survive the struggle, and that he hewed to a singular vision, which was to achieve a new kind of society at the southern tip of Africa that would be non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, and more egalitarian. And while in the first 20 years of democracy, progress towards that vision has come in fits and starts, I think his identification, his articulation, his embodiment of that vision is what elevates him, not only in the hearts and minds of South Africans, but of people all over the world.
Douglas Foster, please stand by in Chicago. Penelope Andrews, today in Albany, New York. Behind us here, the sound of South Africans gathered outside the home of Nelson Mandela to mourn last night with news of his death. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mourners there outside Nelson Mandela's home in Johannesburg last night with news of his death. We are today remembering, honoring Nelson Mandela, talking with South Africans and more about his legacy, their country, the future post-Mandela. Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid Africa, joining us today from Chicago. And South African Penelope Andrews, president and dean of Albany Law School in Albany, New York, author of The Post-Apartheid Constitutions. Nelson Mandela wrote the foreword there. Here he is at his inaugural speech after being coming to power in the first democratic election in South Africa, the first president democratically elected there, 1994.
We know it well that none of us acting alone can achieve success. We must therefore act together as a united people for national reconciliation, for nation building, for the birth of a new world.
The birth of a new world, and somehow in South Africa and far beyond, he came to symbolize that hope. Reel the tape back decades before his 27-year imprisonment, many years on Robben Island. Here was 1961, then 42-year-old Nelson Mandela giving his first ever interview to ITN reporter Brian Widlake, who met Mandela while he was in hiding from the police.
The Africans want the franchise on the basis of one man, one vote. They want political independence.
Do you see Africans being able to develop in this country without the European being pushed out?
We have made it very clear in our policy that South Africa is a country of many races. There is room for all the various races in this country.
Nelson Mandela in 1961, in hiding from police. This is before his famous trial, his speech there, we'll hear a bit of that, before his long, long years in prison on Robben Island. Penelope Andrews, you grew up under apartheid. We will have many listeners who were not yet born when apartheid was fully in effect. Can you just, for those listeners, those young people listening, can you take us back and describe the apartheid system, exactly what it meant for black South Africans?
I think what it fundamentally meant was a very, very segregated life. So I was classified as colored in South Africa. And under the old apartheid racial classifications, very crudely, anybody who wasn't white and who wasn't black was colored, somebody of mixed race origin. But in actual fact, many colored people were descendants of the Javanese and Malaysian slaves that were brought to South Africa by the Dutch in 1652 and later. So, you know, that was the community within which I grew. We were very clear, I think it was very clear, as certainly at a young age, even though when you're a child, the world that you grow up in, that's the normalcy of the world. But I grew up with other colored people. I went to colored schools. My whole life really was around a community of people who were classified in the same way as I was. I became politically active and politically conscious because of the Black Consciousness Movement and an attempt in the, certainly in the 70s, the mid to late 70s, to unite Black South Africans, people who were deemed non-white under the apartheid era, to unite Indians and coloreds and Africans. And I think that was very profound. So I think growing up in South Africa, the world, I happened to grow up in a poor and working class community. And, you know, so the world that I lived in was a world in which, when I looked back, clearly the schools were not, as good as the white schools. We used to travel on buses for non-whites, the part of the train that was for set aside for non-whites. There were movie theaters that we couldn't go to and so on. So it was very much a segregated world, akin to, you know, what happened in this country in the South, you know, during the Jim Crow period and beyond. So that was the world in which I grew in. And it seems like in many ways, a very distant world, although parts of that world remains because economically South Africa still needs to get rid of apartheid. We have ended apartheid politically, but we have not ended economic apartheid. So many of those communities, the Black communities in particular, still live in the areas that, you know, within which we grew up. There's not been a lot of social mobility because of the economic structures that are still in place.
And Douglas Foster, because it's central to the story of Mandela and those around him, remind us of the fierceness, the brutality of the enforcement of apartheid in those years, the fierceness of the crushing of opposition.
Sure. Well, as Penelope said, it was a peculiar and extreme form of racial segregation, very much like the experience in the southern United States. In fact, architects of apartheid came to the U.S. in the late 40s, and in some senses what they were trying to establish countrywide was to do Alabama one step better. It was a brutal system in which legal restrictions on everything, as she said, from where you could live to who you could have sex with and marry, were codified in the law. And where these, you know, of course, unscientific distinctions, colored, native, European, and Indian, which have no basis in anything, were so rigidly enforced. And I think, you know, if you think about that kind of system in place for more than 40 years, following a couple of hundred years of colonialism, it partly answers the question of why there remains such a gap between the vision that Mandela articulated and the current state of the country.
And here he was, Nelson Mandela, 1964, after his famous four-hour speech at his trial and sentencing, was sentenced to life in prison. Nelson Mandela, 1964, saying, if need be, he is prepared to die for the ideals of harmony and equal opportunity. Here's Nelson Mandela, 1964.
I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
The court listened and sent him to prison for decades. He would emerge to be president of South Africa. Phyllis in Middletown, Connecticut. Thank you for calling, Phyllis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would like to understand how he was able to make this enormous shift from a potentially violent militant to a promoter of peace and reconciliation. What accounts for his intellectual and spiritual journey during the years he was in prison?
It's the perfect question. I appreciate your calling, Phyllis. Let me bring in, at that point, Heinz Kluge joins us from Madison, Wisconsin, professor of law at the University of Wisconsin, grew up in Durban, South Africa, and was part of the anti-apartheid struggle. He himself spent 11 years in exile in Botswana, where he ran the Solidarity News Service, returned to South Africa as a member of the ANC Land Commission, chairperson of the ANC Constitutional Committee. Heinz Kluge in Madison, Wisconsin, thank you very much for joining us today. What do you say to our caller's question about how do you chart the evolution of Nelson Mandela's political vision, maybe more than political vision?
Hi, Tom, and to your listeners. Well, first, I wasn't chairperson of the Constitutional Commission, merely an assistant to the chairperson. To answer the question, I think that what's extraordinary is that to understand that right from the beginning, Mandela had a vision and a perspective that was deeply pragmatic as well as militant. And so even though if you look back to the early period of his life when he was militant, forming the youth wing to push the ANC to do more dramatic demonstrations in merely appealing to the Queen in England, he at every moment was prepared to adopt strategies and methods that he felt would work rather than some purely ideological positions. And so even though he would he adopted nonviolence, and when that was cut off and the regime banned the ANC and killed 69 people at Sharpeville, he was as he went underground and took up arms, he was still calling on the government to negotiate.
Penelope, please negotiate, but they didn't. And so then he went to arms. Maybe it was purely pragmatic, but Penelope Andrews, do you know about his inspirations, who he read, who he followed? Was Gandhi a significant figure to him, or perhaps others? What about his philosophical evolution?
Well, I think, the stories that, and certainly this has been documented and written about both by Mandela and others, Robben Island was in many ways like a university. It was a learning laboratory. And people read and spoke and developed ideas. So I think you start off with Mandela as the leader going to prison. Clearly already the ideas of the Freedom Charter and what South Africa was to become, that was part of him. And then, the ideas sort of developing and growing in prison. And he comes out of prison at the age of 71. The whole world has adopted the anti-apartheid struggle. Nelson Mandela is the world's political prisoner. And so he comes into a world in which almost it's ripe for the idealism that he unleashed. But all the values and the principles in many ways were in place. We had 40 years of international human rights activism. I think the United Nations had declared apartheid a crime against humanity. And I think that really contributed to the sense of what the South African struggle was about and what Nelson Mandela represented. So I think the shift was both personal and it was political, but it was the context and the moment. It was the world was ripe for the idealism of this one man and the movement that he represented to become part of this movement to a democratic South Africa.
Michelle in Columbia, South Carolina. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I'm 69, so I followed apartheid even while I was in Germany in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to say that Mandela did follow Gandhi. He did try to civil disobedience. But when the people in Sparksville came to the police and said, "We don't have our passes," the police shot them. I think it was 76, 79.
Nearly, yeah.
Killed.
Yes.
And then that's when he went underground and decided that it wouldn't work. And, of course, when he came out and apologized, those were the things that he was apologizing for, that he went and did terrible things, killed people. But while he was in prison, I think that's when he realized that nonviolence will work. And that was the only way not only to bring South Africa together, but maybe to bring the whole world together.
Michelle, I appreciate your call. Here's a very interesting bit of tape. This was Nelson Mandela on the other side of all that in the year 2000. He talked with Oprah, and he talked there about how he had decided he needed to suppress his anger and those angry emotions in order to help his country.
Our emotion said the white minority is an enemy. We must never talk to them. But our brain said, if you don't talk to this man, your country will go up in flames. And for many years to come, this country will be engulfed in rivers of blood. So we had to reconcile that conflict. And our talking to the enemy was the result of the domination of the brain over emotions. I hated oppression. And when I think about the past, the type of things they did, I feel angry. You have a limited time to stay on Earth. You must try and use that period for the purpose of transforming your country into what you desire it to be.
Heinz Kluge, you worked in the anti-apartheid movement. There's an inspiring man right there. Now Nelson Mandela is gone. What's your sense for all those who had admired him over the years, even called him their hero? What does his legacy require now? What do we owe this man, his legacy, Heinz?
I think one of the largest things we owe is to continue to understand the complexity of his life, and that he both, first of all, to the last speaker, he never murdered anybody. He formed the Umkhonto weSizwe, which was the armed wing of the ANC, but he himself was never in armed combat. But that aside, the legacy that we have to pick up on is not just that the reconciliation part, which is what a lot of people are talking about, but also the fact that he demanded that a free South Africa also addresses the inequalities that apartheid left behind. And that's the part of the legacy that the challenge to all South Africans and everybody else, that to address that legacy isn't just from one day to the next, and the gross inequalities that continue to haunt South Africa have to be addressed if we're going to actually honor the life that we are honoring today.
There is great work that remains to be done in South Africa and well beyond. Heinz Kluge, professor of law at the University of Michigan.
Wisconsin.
I'm sorry, University of Wisconsin. Forgive me, of course, in Madison, Wisconsin. Was active in the anti-apartheid struggle. Professor Kluge, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Douglas Foster in Chicago, Penelope Andrews in Albany, please stand by. We are remembering, honoring Nelson Mandela in this hour. You can join us. You remember how bad it was in apartheid, South Africa. Did you rally to the anti-apartheid cause, to Mandela? How will you explain to your children, maybe your students today, the importance, the meaning of this man? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Here's the old church hymn, God Bless Africa. Later became a song of political defiance against South Africa's apartheid government and then merged into the new national anthem years later. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are remembering Nelson Mandela today. Douglas Foster joins us from Chicago, author of After Mandela. Penelope Andrews from Albany, South African, president and dean of Albany Law School. I want to go right to South Africa again, if we may, and Cape Town. Janet Hurd joins us, assistant editor and head of news at Cape Times. Janet Hurd, in Cape Town, what are you seeing there today as your country takes on the news of Nelson Mandela's death?
Great. I'm actually right in the center of Cape Town right now, and we've just been to an interfaith service at the Grand Parade, where this is the venue where Mandela was when he first addressed the crowd after he was released from prison. So it's a very symbolic venue, and people gathered there, thousands of people have just gathered there to pay tribute to him and to honor him and to just sort of absorb the moment, really, which is just really such a huge, overwhelming moment in Cape Town right now, yeah.
Janet, do you see...
A little bit noisy outside.
Yeah, do you see South African whites and blacks and everything in between observing this together? Is it a vision of what he dreamed of or not as you celebrate his life?
The service today is a very good example of complete non-racial sort of crowd with people of all races, all religions, all denominations. They had different prayers from really right across the religious spectrum. And it was a very sort of white, black, every kind of creed at the event. So it was a really beautiful, moving occasion. There was a little bit of a political edge with sort of kind of a tinge of political opportunism on the political party side, but it was very kind of, it really didn't overwhelm in any way. And the overwhelming feeling was, wow, you know, this is what Mandela was about altogether.
And do you sense...
Sorry,
Janet, but do you sense optimism in the air that Mandela's vision for prosperity and dignity for all in South Africa can be achieved? Or do you sense fear that in his absence, South Africa may slide back?
You know, at the moment, South Africans, I think, are not even thinking about that. I think South Africans really just want to pay respect to Mandela this week, especially. So the feeling of the moment is really just to a feeling of respect for this man who has played such a role in so many people's lives, that the sort of tomorrow is not really where people's heads are at right now. and it's quite to respect him and pay him the dignity that really he deserves. There's obviously worries, but those worries have been around anyway. You know, they haven't just like, we haven't woken up this morning to think, oh my gosh, everything's going to go downhill. By no means. I don't think that there's an immediate dramatic switch in any way. Mandela has been ill for some time, so I think the country's been getting ready to say goodbye to him. So that, there isn't that kind of immediate feeling. But the overwhelming thing today, I think, is the respect for this man and to really pay tribute to him to sort of absorb the moment of the significance of this man in our lives.
Respect for the man and all he accomplished and all he articulated, a deeply deserved respect. Janet Hurd in South Africa in Cape Town at the Cape Times. Thank you very much for being with us on this day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Here's President Obama speaking from the White House yesterday about Nelson Mandela.
We will not likely see the likes of Nelson Mandela again. So it falls to us, as best we can, to for the example that he set, to make decisions guided not by hate but by love, to never discount the difference that one person can make, to strive for a future that is worthy of his sacrifice.
President Obama on Nelson Mandela. Penelope Andrews, Douglas Foster. We asked our listeners on Facebook what about his life might inspire them, and lots of responses. There, Jesse writing, a man of unfathomable strength. His life was a great gift to humankind. Matthew saying, he proved vast change can be accomplished in a person's life, even under government and militant opposition. Barbara saying she'll remember that he smiled and continued to speak to us after his time as a prisoner. And Neil writing to us, he'll remember the moral authority because he was morally right. Saying, writing here, we all need to live our lives morally. David in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I've always regarded Mandela as my hero. I grew up in Kenya myself.
Mm-hmm.
And having grown up in Kenya and watched a lot of African leaders, they don't usually want to step out of power. But Mandela paid a bigger price for independence and reconciliation. However, he led the country, gave them the victory.
David, I'm afraid we lost you right there, but we hear the hero seen by our Kenyan caller. And one more right here, Karen in Worcester, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on.
Hi, I'm just calling because my parents grew up under apartheid, and they moved so that I did not grow up under apartheid. But when I grew up worrying that that there would be a bloody revolution and that my relatives there would all be killed.
Your family was white, I take it then, Karen.
Yes, my family was white, and some members of my family were very active in the resistance, and actually had to leave quickly. So it was always a worry that there was going to be a bloody revolution. We knew, I knew at a young age it was there were five times as many black people as white people. So if it was one man, one vote, the fear was that it would be just so the fear was the white government would never let that happen. And what Mandela accomplished after 27 years in prison, I mean, I always thought after 27 years in prison, I wouldn't know my own name, and just to, for him to cling to that, I think was just amazing. It changed, it changed my family very much. I grew up with that cloud over my head.
Yeah, a fear of a bloody outcome to all those years of oppression. Karen, I so appreciate your call. Penelope Andrews, I mean, it just remains astonishing that Nelson Mandela, not alone, but in such great part, was able to articulate a vision to unwind all those years of brutal oppression without a bloodbath.
Absolutely. And I think the thing is that one must not forget the role of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which really was an important vehicle through which the anger and the bitterness could be channeled. And South Africa could not go from apartheid to democracy without something like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So I think the TRC was very, very important. And the TRC performed many functions, but one was really to reassure whites that there was not going to be a bloodbath, but that there would be some way in which there would be redress and that people would take responsibility for the injustices and the brutality of apartheid. The fear that people had just didn't transpire, and it had to do with Nelson Mandela and the movement that he represented and the people who were around him, Archbishop Tutu, mm-hmm. Walter Sisulu, all the great people of the liberation movement who eventually, came to make up the new government. And then, of course, the people inside South Africa from the Black Consciousness Movement and later the United Democratic Front and so on, these communities of people who understood that as much as there was anger and bitterness, that South Africa needed to come to a place of reconciliation and forgiveness, and that is what Mandela captured in the most vital way.
Fear of a bloodbath after so much injustice, and then February 1990, Nelson Mandela walks out of prison, the whole world watching, and here's this man smiling and yet very determined. Here he was delivering a speech to a huge crowd after being released from those 27 years in prison, calling for the international community then to continue its campaign, many involved globally, against apartheid. Mandela, 1990.
To lift sanctions now would be to run the risk of aborting the process towards the complete eradication of apartheid. Our march to freedom is irreversible. We must not allow fear to stand in our way.
Nelson Mandela, in the month of his release from 27 years in prison. Douglas Foster, when he walked out, was it clear what the resolution of all this would be? How much was still up in the air?
Not at all. It wasn't at all clear. And the thing people forget is that what followed that release was more than 4 years of very, very tough negotiations between the liberation forces led by Mandela and the white regime. He didn't come out of prison and an election fall into his lap. In fact, it may be his greatest contribution, greater than the sacrifices he made in prison, or his service as president, or even his illustrious post-presidential career. That period of negotiation in which the ANC leaders prepared to take over government and negotiated an end to white minority rule was very, very tricky and involved making huge compromises that he was sharply criticized still today. Well, maybe not today, in the streets and in the townships for having, you know, in the view of some, bent over backward too far in the direction of reconciliation and failed to emphasize enough the need for social and economic justice. And I think part of the conversation that will come probably after this period of mourning and leading into the presidential election campaign, the results in an election in April, 20 years after the advent of democracy, will be on those questions of social and economic justice.
Of course, Douglas, even today, some of those voices here, I'm reading an op-ed in the New York Times saying that his government, citing critics, saying it focused on the cosmetics of reconciliation while, quoting here, nothing materially changed in the lives of a majority of South Africans. Of course, a lot changed politically, but yet there stands still a reality. Mark in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Mark, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. I found myself in 1979 in a school in Swaziland that was opened because by my church because of the South African refugees who fled from the Soweto uprising. And I was in the classroom one day when a number of the students decided they would go to join the armed wing of the ANC and a number who would stay and study to prepare for the future.
Wow.
I had many conversations with those students who were incredibly angry, who had been there when their friends were shot to death by the apartheid regime.
Mm-hmm.
And we would I remember one particular time when I said, one day this will be behind us. And we thought, maybe in 100 years.
Yeah.
And it's just such a remarkable thing that Nelson Mandela was able to lead the people, and the white South Africans as well, who,
yes,
many of them who were incredibly sincere Christian people who wanted to have justice prevail as well, led them into a different frame of mind. So I often wonder about my students because I've lost touch with them, of course, and what are they doing? Did they live? Did they die? You know, that's the kind of things I'm remembering at this time.
Yes, and many, of course, many did die, many imprisoned. Mark, taking us back to the day, 1979, when there was a decision in his class, in part, to go off and fight, in part, who would not. Peter Foster, what about the future for this country now? You write with some apprehension about its future on the other side of Mandela. We're here to honor him, but yet South Africa's fate is central to Mandela's story.
It is. You know, his vision of establishing this non-racial and non-sexist, more egalitarian society is an open question, I think, particularly since, you know, democracy arrived on the same day virtually as the HIV/AIDS pandemic and hooking the country back up to an advanced capitalist system in which equality is often a feature of that system. So it's a huge challenge, but it's not a challenge just for South Africans.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge for us as well, because at the present moment, there's very little room for developing countries to establish a kind of manufacturing sector in the rest, which allows ladders for people to join the middle class. So I think there are two sides of the ledger. One, 2 million black South Africans have entered middle-income status in the last 20 years. Not enough, but also not nothing. Important mm-hmm. to see things on both sides of the ledger. On the other hand, the vast preponderance of black young people are unemployed in a black majority country. And that, of course, isn't sustainable. But it's also not sustainable that a global trading system should allow Brazil to produce all the agricultural goods, China to produce all the textile goods, India to do all the call centers, and the U.S. to accumulate global debt. That system isn't sustainable, not only here, but there. And so this is probably a day for Americans in particular to think about the system, systematic changes that need to be made that allow the advancement towards that vision that Mandela articulated and celebrated. Otherwise, we're sort of giving with one hand,
yeah,
celebrating an amazing individual, but failing to really grasp what he was calling us to do.
Not just reconciliation. He also spoke so deeply, so persistently of justice and dignity. Here he was at his 90th birthday in London, June of 2008, addressing a 50,000-strong crowd.
After nearly 90 years of life, it is time for new hands to lift the burdens. It is in your hands now. I thank you.
It is in your hands now. Penelope Andrews, there's a challenge in that. What is that challenge? What was Mandela saying? Please
well,
carry
I think
on.
I think the challenge is, and this is something that I agree with what Douglas has just said, the challenge really is for us is in South Africa and globally to carry on the ideals and the vision that was so much part of Nelson Mandela's, that is now part of Nelson Mandela's legacy and what he stood for. I think just, for example, the themes of economic inequality and poverty. When Mandela was interviewed on Oprah, one of the things that he said, I'll not forget, he spoke about the poor, and he says, dealing with the poor is not an act of charity, but an act of justice. Similarly, around reconciliation, there are people in the world today fighting, you know, based on religion, ethnicity, and so on. I think that what Mandela stood for and those principles can help. So I think it's a clarion call for us to not just celebrate him as just this momentary act of celebration, but really to carry on in a fundamental way. Those of us who have those of us who have influence, those of us who are educated, just to ensure that the world becomes a better place.
Penelope, we're out of time right there, but that word justice is a good one to go with. Penelope Andrews at Albany Law School, Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela. Thanks to both of you. We'll go out with music from South Africa, remembering Nelson Mandela.